When I was about as tall as my father's elbow, as he judiciously bent it in the 9 taverns of our town, I saw a lot of the makings of the West. Among his own many Western aspects, he'd been a homestead kid, bronc buster, sheep herder, short order cook. My father was a haymaker, a haying contractor, a kind of freelance foreman, who would hire his own crew and put up the hay for the rancher for so much per ton. Those saloons where I was lucky enough to tag along with him were his hiring halls, and as he would sound out a hay hand on whether the guy had ever run a power buck rake and where, there would be the ritual of the men fumbling into their shirt pockets with the little white tobacco sack and book of rolling papers. Bull Durham and a Bible, as they called the cigarette papers. The makings of the hand-rolled cigarettes they smoked as they talked of haystacks and summer wages. Ingredients are the butter cookies of memory, and just as that famous nibble into a bit of French pastry set Proust off into volumes of intricate remembrance of things past, too in our own remembrance of things west, try to see all of what's been made since back there at the makings. That blue smoke of sociableness, as my father and his hay hands lit up in the Maverick bar, I reported in This House of Sky this way. Opening the door from the street was like finding yourself in a sudden roaring fog. In the novel about today's West that I'm working on now, it's noted that a familiar new store on Western small-town streets is the medical equipment dealer, with oxygen supplies for the emphysema sufferers. And making hay? I incongruously was an eyewitness to the change of that as a college kid. By then, the early 1960s, the days of the hay contractor were gone, at least in our part of Montana, where stacks of loose hay like giant bread loaves on the prairie long had been the method. And ranchers had bought their own swathers and balers. But hay still was being stacked in bales, and crews still were hired, of young summer muscle such as I was then, to do that bale piling. The 2 other bale pilers I worked with and I all caught a kind of fever of pride that summer, and we worked our proverbial tails off, trying to build the tightest, prettiest bale stacks in the country. Our boss, the rancher, kept telling us that's what he wanted. On that same ranch, the very next summer, I saw the arrival of a self-piling trailer which hitched behind the baling machine. The cost of it, no doubt, would have paid a piling crew's wages for many summers, and it dumped its accumulated bales into wobbly, unweatherproof heaps which would have got us mere mortals fired by noon of the first day. But here the contraption was, religiously being used because it eliminated a hired man. That taught me a lot about what the mechanizing world thought of the human ingredient. The list is long. That's what history is for. An evening speaker's time span is supposed to be finite, however, and so I'm mostly going to talk as a working writer, someone who sits around in his own head all the time and fumbles with the makings. Patty Limerick spilled the beans that I do have a degree in history, but I'm actually only a tourist in the stuff, just passing through, honest. A fascinated tourist, I admit, and one with a funny straddle between hanging around with Patty and the other New West historians, as they get so sick of being called, and the prior generation who had Western history in their custody when I was a student. As an undergraduate at Northwestern, I used to sit in occasionally on the Western history course taught by Ray Allen Billington, one of the traditionalists whose version of history Patricia Nelson Limerick, say, is an adversary of. Patty takes on adversaries living and dead. Ray Allen Billington wrote the textbook we used when I was in graduate school, So that we got to read about the construction of the transcontinental railroads this way. Nightly dissipation did not slow down the workers who, by the spring of 1868, realized they were not mere laborers on a railroad, but participants in the greatest race in history. The Central Pacific was winging across the level deserts of Nevada. The Union Pacific was battling through South Pass. Now, a writer really ought to go for that. Winging, battling, active verbs. But I remember even then being troubled by the fact that, battling or otherwise, the Union Pacific Railroad never passed within a good many miles of South Pass, Wyoming. So, when the New West historians are accused of de-glamorizing the West, we do need to consider what version of the West they're kicking the glamour out of. Remember, it's fairly recent in our past that the cultural images of the West were guys like Louis L'Amour and John Wayne, with a pound of belt buckle trying to hold up 25 extra pounds of gut. Something had to give way. Well, writers, what are they up to? Let me just give you some idea of the makings of books, of how at least some of us as writers, Western-born, others fervent adoptees of the region, try to put the West together, make its stories and characters speak up in our pages. They call it regional, this relevance, the deepest place we have. In this pool forms the model of our land, a lonely one, responsive to the wind. Everything we own has brought us here. From here we speak. That poem, Lake Chelan, by William Stafford, the late great Oregon poet, I think reminds us that the West is delineated by more than state lines and survey lines and property lines. Lines of poetry, lines of prose, also mark out for us this deepest place we have. The strongest of poetry and storytelling comes right up off the page into our lives. I want to move for the next several minutes to some instances of what I never know what to call except the slow poetry of fact. Writers get paid, at least once in a while, not to think in absolutely straight lines. So I'm going to argue to you that even when the best of today's American Western writing happens to be prose, it still arises out of that slow poetry of fact. Out of the arithmetic of particulars, dabs of makings, which creatively get added up into story. Let me take you briefly through this writerly process of the poetry of fact accumulating itself, using an example I know best, my own. Among the countless colored coats that fact can wear, this particular time it was dressed old-fashioned, black and white and red all over, that old pun about newspapers before they became such an endangered species. The accumulated century of the weekly newspaper of Shoto, Montana, the grandly named Shoto Acantha, actually are in red protective binders in the public library there in the small town of Shoto. And so, this becomes a Thursday. The evening the Shoto Public Library stays open past supper time, and I am at a table on the library's little mezzanine, going through old newsprint, to hear into that area of Montana during the Depression years, the drought years. In mid-February of 1939, the homespun local columnist reports that there had been a heavy fog, unusual to that climate and time of year. A stirring begins on the library stairs, and up comes a group of women from a Hutterite colony near Shoto. In their long skirts and patterned aprons and kerchiefs, these religious communal dwellers might have just stepped out of the pages of Tolstoy. I think of Paul Horgan, who, when he got tired of always being called a Southwestern writer, said that artists in all forms have always paid homage to their home territory. Everybody is a regionalist, Horgan said. Tolstoy is a regionalist. I open the next red binder. The columnist is saying in the issue of May 18, 1939, if the adage of rain 90 days after a fog holds good, a heavy soaking rain will come on the 21st. Steps on the mezzanine stairs again. A ranch wife appears and begins browsing forcefully through the fiction shelves. No nonsense about it as she flips open novels and takes or rejects them on the basis of their opening sentence. I reopen the red binder to the next week's newspaper, May 25th, 1939, which reports that a downpour started in the early morning of the 22nd. It went on all through the day and into the night, an inch and two-thirds of rain before it quit. Opportune for the crops, the homespun columnist states with satisfaction about that fog forecast goose drowner. And I sit thinking of all the rain that must have seemed like, after the years of drought, the land suddenly swimming with valuable moisture, and more of it coming as May went off the calendar wetly. Steps on the stairs. It is the volunteer evening librarian telling me apologetically that she has to close up now. I close the red binder on the 1939 newspapers, go out into the summer night there under the northern Rockies. A couple of years later, when my novel English Crick is published, there in my fictional version of the summer of 1939, a forceful ranch-born woman named Beth McCaskill shows up almost immediately, and the book's opening sentence reads, "That month of June swam into the Two Medicine Country." Fact, I'm glad to say, also goes out to eat and drink. And here in the West, that sometimes can be especially slow and poetic. There is a delicious hunger of the ear behind stories, either the hearing of them or the telling of them. And I spend a lot of time simply following the sound of voices. It begins at breakfast in Shoto, Montana, or Cortez, Colorado, or Grangeville, Idaho, when the guys in tractor caps take over their usual table and start drinking coffee and solving the world's problems. Folklorists actually have a term for these caffeine circles. They call them the big table. I've always just called them the geezer table. But in any case, those gatherings over morning coffee or 4th of July rodeo picnic potato salad or evening imbibings in bars usually called the Stockman or the Mint, those are a rhythm of the West that I, at least, believe is worth some listening to. Something must account for this kind of example. A bit of dialogue in my novel, Ride With Me, Mariah Montana, overheard between two Ole beer drinkers. "Tell you, Ron, I don't know what you got going with Barbara Joe, but don't let her get you in front of no minister. This marriage stuff is really crappy. You take Jeannie's mom is always on my back about why don't we come over more. But we go over there and the stuff she cooks, she never salts anything or anything. And I don't eat that crap without no salt on it. Last time she called up and asked Jeannie why we weren't coming over, I told Jeannie to tell her I had to lay down and rest. Then there's Jeannie's dad. He just got dried out down at Great Falls. Cranky old son of a bitch. I think they ought to let him have a few beers so he wouldn't be so much of a crap head is what I think. You know what else? Jeannie's brother and sister-in-law had a 4th of July picnic and didn't even invite us. That's the kind of people they are. Jeannie and I have been talking a lot lately. I told her I about had it with her crappy family. Just as soon as the first of the year and I get enough money ahead to buy my big bike, I'm heading out to the coast and go to school somewhere. Yeah? Ron responded. What in? Social work. In this particular case, that swatch of bar talk was about half overheard, including, I swear on an oral history manual, that punchline, and half made up by me. The made-up half has in it the trace element of fact that wasn't there for me as an eavesdropper, folklorist, oral historian, researcher, or whatever. The echo of Exodus that sweeps back and forth in the West, this time our incipient social worker's dream of heading out to the coast. This is part of the job description of the writer, I think, letting other voices speak the situation. Thus we get such accuracies as the line in Wallace Stegner's short story, Carrion Spring. The young ranchman, who modernly might be described as suffering a lack of communication with the young wife he has brought to the bald prairies of Saskatchewan, but who, when they meet up with the hard-used son of the local wolf hunter, can say to the boy the perfect pitch sentence, "How've you been doing on wolves?" That "on" is one of the best prepositions ever. By the same token of small talk with a lot big behind it, from Marie Sandoz, early in Old Jewels, we take in a lasting intimation when the ranch cook cracks to the young Swiss homesteader about his chosen land in the sand hills of Nebraska. "Great farming country. Never get your crops wet there." So, creative listening is one thing a writer can use in this process of trying to put things together there on the page. Another main tool is eyesight. At least I've always found it a good idea when I'm attempting to write about something to do with the West to go out and take a look at it. This is as true for fiction as it is for memoir or other nonfiction. For my first novel, The Sea Runners, the story of an escape by canoe from Alaska, Russian America in the middle of the 19th century, to the Columbia River, I bummed a ride down as much of that coast as I could aboard the University of Alaska oceanography vessel. The captain let me stand beside him in the wheelhouse, and from an hour before dawn until after dark, from Juneau to Seattle, day after day I stood and looked at that coast and water and made notes about it, right beneath the big red sign that said, "Crew members only allowed in the wheelhouse." You sometimes have to stand a long way back to see what you're looking for in the West, and I should give this audience this particular example. When I wanted to write a novel about the West's homesteaders, I went back to where my own homesteading grandparents started from, Scotland. I plundered various archives there, but a particular find was at the University of St. Andrews, which had a collection of letters written home by emigrants who had made the ship journey to America. I was looking for details of shipboard life, and one letter writer, David McNeil, was terrific at it. His description of the impromptu bazaar on deck when the steamship made its stop in the harbor of Cork, Ireland, with the Irish women scrambling aboard to sell food and other wares, and then, when the whistle signaled departure, flying over the side like cats. McNeil's material was so good that it made me decide to put my own title material into that scene, "Dancing at the Rascal Fair," a ditty my young goers to America sing every so often. Dancing at the Rascal Fair, devils and angels all were there, heel and toe, pair by pair, dancing at the Rascal Fair. As you may recognize, it's a traditional old Scottish song that I made up. We practitioners call that the new Scotch history. David McNeil's usefulness to me as a describer didn't quit there, as he went on to tell about a storm at sea, which I also used. And his vividness didn't even quit when he reached shore. He came on west to Colorado and reported about Denver. Denver looks as if it commenced last week and might be moved somewhere else next. Perspective is everything, isn't it? The writers whom I've been quoting wholesale here, Stafford, Stegner, Sandoz, yours truly, and some yet to come, all have at least one thing in common, And that's having known the outdoors West, the rural West, as Stegner might put it, ever since their legs were long enough to reach the ground. Well, we do need, and I think we'll soon have, a generation of writers similarly savvy about the urban and suburban West. The West never likes to admit that its capital is maybe California, but that's going to have to be faced sooner or later in our literature. There's another such group since the passing of Stegner and company, a sort of writing generation of us out here now, who, without consulting each other about it, have decided to use our own Western lives and backgrounds, the stuff we ought to know best, as the raw material for our books. Of course, it took a historian to point out to us what we're doing. It was Richard Maxwell Brown, now Professor Emeritus of Pacific Northwest History at the University of Oregon, the only man I've ever known who somehow manages to read everything. In his looking over of Western writing, Richard Maxwell Brown cites me and this House of Sky and Hard Earth, so I will blushingly skip over that part. But he lists several recent books where nemesis and tragedy, bitterness and beauty, and other universals of human life meet, and which add up to what he calls the West's grassroots autobiography and biography. William Kittredge's memoir, Hole in the Sky, Refuge by Terry Tempest Williams, Rain or Shine by Syra McFadden, Mary Clearman Blue's brilliant set of books, Balsam Root and All But the Waltz. I would add to his list Teresa Jordan's Riding the White Horse Home, and one that was published last spring, Kim Barnes' remembrance of coming of age in a logging family on the Clearwater River of Idaho, In the Wilderness. Talk about makings. Kim Barnes' parents and relatives were called pole makers, loggers who carefully felled trees that were the right thickness for telephone poles. The characteristics of this literary grassroots trend, Brown says, include these. The simple but powerful formula of the grassroots reality of our region, place plus family. These biographies and autobiographies are unusually vivid in their evocation of both family and place. The authors are all extremely talented and also notably reflective. Their books are implicitly conceptual, but not overtly so. They appeal to the mind by first reaching the emotions of the reader. The intellectual appeal of these books is subtle but strong. Their authors are trained intellects. Most of them have graduate degrees and support themselves by work in the realm of ideas. And finally, this new grassroots trend is a meeting ground of the literary talent and the social history of the West, Brown says. That, then, is at least an early historical take on where Western writing has been heading toward lately. Well, they call it regional, this relevance. But there's one last ingredient by which I believe writers can move the central power of literature to where they are in the world. This bit of makings we can identify and name by our own style of putting things together here in the West, naturally, as the crocodile factor. Like so much else that has to do with the heart and soul of the American West, I owe this final bit of writerly psyche to the late Richard Hugo, the bigger-than-life poet of Washington and Montana. In teaching aspiring poets, Hugo used to advise, "When in doubt, throw in a crocodile." Among the things he meant by that are a list of pretended assumptions that he would use when he set out to write a poem, he said. As he told it in his terrific book on writing, The Triggering Town, "Whenever I see a town that triggers whatever it is inside me that wants to write a poem, I assume at least one of the following." And I'll give you just a few from Richard Hugo's long list. "I am an outcast returned, Years ago, the police told me to never come back, but after all this time, I assume that either I'll be forgiven or I will not be recognized. On Saturday nights, everyone has fun but me. I sit home alone and listen to the radio. I wish I could join the others, though I enjoy feeling left out. The town was once supported by mining, commercial fishing, or farming. No one knows what supports it now. Hugo's kind of adjuration to the imagination is said many ways, probably in all forms of art. When the great carver Bill Reed was asked why his tribe, the Haidas, were the preeminent artists of the Northwest coastal tribes, he said the Haidas simply out-crazied everybody else. But I've always liked Hugo's crocodile prescription and think it covers a lot of otherwise unexplainable wonders of prose, too. The go-for-broke elements that come right up off the page and get you. William Faulkner's crocodile was simply that haunting fever dream prose of his in which, as a boggled critic once said, the sentences advance like armies. John Gardner, in his time, was one of the most industrious and respectable American novelists, but I never liked anything else of his nearly as much as when he took a chance and retold the Beowulf legend from the monster's point of view in his novel Grendel. There may be no more wonderfully crocodilian sentence than the one after Grendel the narrator has rampaged through a mead hall. I silently sack up my dead. Writers about the American West have done some inspired engineering on the crocodile factor, I'm happy to say. Louise Erdrich's kaleidoscopic shifts of points of view and points of time in her stories which add up to novels are often Faulknerianly brilliant. James Welch took the poetic fact that the historic Blackfeet believed animals sometimes spoke to them, and from there made perhaps the greatest leap any of us of this writing generation is going to make toward the soul of our people, when in his novel Fool's Crow, he has the non-human creatures of their cosmos telling his Blackfeet characters what's up. Mary Clearman Blue, from one of the grassroots memoirs I mentioned, Balsam Root, has coaxed one of the fiercest of crocodiles, the mysteries of one's own family, into a brilliant narrative technique which makes a memoir read with the flow of a fast-paced novel. For my part, to close this out with somebody whose motives I'm supposed to be sure of, among the things I've tried to do is show a community of time as well as of people. I realize it's been said time was invented so that everything doesn't happen at once, but those of us trying to keep track of the West know that a lot of life does happen that way, don't we? I knew when I set out to write Bucking the Sun that I wanted to deal with a big, contentious family at one of history's turning points. The five couples in the Duff family I thought up and plopped them into the Depression years. And the pint-sized sheriff they bedevil, and the boomtown life and work flavor of building the biggest dam in the world then, Fort Peck Dam on the Upper Missouri River. As I worked away at what ultimately became 350-some scenes gliding in and out of the characters' lives, it dawned on me, these people have to sleep sometime. That was the making of this page in Bucking the Sun. The dream work of Fort Peck, built through the November nights, turbulent, drifting on the dark change of season and work and prospect, restless inside the bone hulls of fate, thousands of sleep-made privacies tossing and turning. The boom town of Wheeler, with its alcohol content, tended toward inward uproar. Showdowns, arguments won on a second try, woozy, otherwise unimaginable sexual situations. In the Corps of Engineers town site, along Officer's Row, the dreams held a tendency toward hierarchy. Colonel Parmenter's vision of a command post in the blissful, sweltering Philippines. And Mrs. Parmenter's nocturnal jaunt backward 30 years and 30 pounds to her cotillion debut, both overriding, say, Captain Brasco's delirious arm-waving scene with garbage men who were delivering garbage into his tidy streets instead of hauling it away. Across a few of those streets, in the workers' barracks, Darius Duff dreamt back to Scotland. One floor up from him, the cook, Tim Jarala, was shaking dice in the saloons of Wheeler and winning. In both towns, in the course of any night, more than one man dreamt of the peroxide blonde taxi dancer, Proxy Shannon. Within the walls of the Duffs, Hugh, the family patriarch, was on metal horseback, riding a workhorse. It seemed to be the broad-beamed dun nag they called Hippo back on the homestead, through the snowdrifts of the road between Fort Peck and Glasgow. Hugh thought it odd he was drawing wages for this, merely riding around in the snow, but who was he to complain? His wife of 3 decades, Meg, beside him in bed and not, was on the bandstand of the Blue Eagle Saloon, where she could peer over the heads of the drinking crowd, watching and watching, till finally she saw him come in through the door, the tall, familiar figure of Hugh. It was Hugh, wasn't it? Their son Bruce, the government diver, slept the sleep of the underwater walker, stupefied but unalarmed, while his wife Kate wanted out of the dream she was in, or she was trying to wait on her customers at the Rondola Cafe and feed her baby Jack on her breast at the same time, and the smartasses along the counter kept saying, "I'll have what Jackie's having." Meanwhile, her sister-in-law Rosellen, who had been sending off stories to magazines, was stalled in a reverie version of the Fort Peck post office, waiting for the mail. Every time she went up to the wicket window and asked, "Is there any for me?" the postmaster would say, "Did you bring a gunny sack for it?" and then laugh and turn away. Minutes before, Rosellen's husband Neil woke up on a rancher's approach road halfway between Fort Peck and the coal mine, having pulled over to doze when he thought he might fall asleep at the wheel on his trucking run, and now had climbed out and was walking around and around the truck to get himself warm and awake enough to drive home. Rosellen's sister Charlene, by contrast, was steaming in her dream, trying to run a hairdresser shop the size of a department store, customers and chairs even up on the mezzanine. The only help she had was her mother-in-law, Meg, who kept asking, "Charlene, tell me again what to do when they say they want the works." And working at sleep next to Charlene, in sessions that were more like naps linked together, lay Owen Duff, engineer of this dam, perpetually trying to get somewhere on a train, but every single time the conductor came by and demanded his ticket, Owen could not find the thing. That, I believe, is the note to end on, that not just in dream, but in art and history, we have to keep looking at our makings to find out where we in the West are going. Thank you.